is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Hey, Hoopheads, wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. We've had their partnership manager and training specialist, Jefferson Mason, and marketing manager, Nick Bartlett, on the show in the past, and we couldn't be more excited about what they're doing for the game of basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market, and truly accelerate skill development faster than ever. Beyond efficient reps, Dr. Dish provides training expertise and versatility designed to develop complete players. The new Dr. Dish CT machine has further revolutionized basketball training with over 150 plus on-demand individual and team workouts from some of the best coaches and trainers in the game. These workouts include video instruction and combine game-like shooting drills with ball handling, conditioning, and agility drills. Along with workouts, the Dr. Dish training management system also provides stat tracking and analytics to track progress and ensure accountability. These are just a few reasons why top programs like Duke, North Carolina, Louisville, Florida, Baylor, and countless others are upgrading to Dr. Dish. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com. Follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. And make sure you mention the Hoopheads podcast to get $300 off your next Dr. Dish purchase. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get out and get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
I always tell my guys, I'm going to love you before practice. I'm going to love you after practice. We're going to be close and we're going to joke around. We're going to have a great time. But as soon as that whistle starts and as soon as that whistle ends, you know, in between those lines, you're not going to like me for a while, which is fine. I think the best coaches are the best teachers.
Todd Wolfson is the boys' head varsity basketball coach at St. Francis High School in California. Growing up in the San Fernando Valley as a three-year varsity player at El Camino Real High School in Woodland Hills, Todd always knew he wanted to become a high school coach. Wolfson attended UC Santa Barbara, where he studied communications and his focus switched from playing to coaching. Wolfson began his coaching career at his alma mater, spending two seasons at El Camino Real High School from 2005 to 2007. In 2007, Todd took over the program at Chaminade High School, where in 2014, his Eagles went 27-6 and won the first ever California State Championship in the history of the school. Todd was named CIF Coach of the Year in 2009, the youngest coach to ever receive that honor. Wolfson took over the St. Francis Golden Knights basketball team in 2015. By 2018, the team had won 24 games and reached the third round of the CIF playoffs. And in 2019, the Golden Knights advanced to the CIF California State Championship game. Coach Wolfson's philosophy always circles back to the question, is this putting my teammates before myself? If you have a chance to leave us a 5-star rating and review on your favorite podcast app, we would really appreciate it. Tell your friends in the coaching community about the show, and make sure you're subscribed so you never miss an episode. Check out hoopheadspod.com, where you can listen to every episode we've ever recorded, and find out more about what drives our show. You can also sign up to receive our weekly newsletter to gain even more access to great content from our guests. Get ready to take some notes as you listen to this episode with Todd Wolfson from St. Francis High School in the state of California.
Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here without my co-host Jason Sunkel, who I think he and I are going to be back together in person next week as his month-old daughter is slowly coming around and being more cooperative. So we're looking forward to getting back together with Jason in person. Tonight, we are pleased to welcome to the podcast from St. Francis High School in California, Todd Wolfson. Todd, welcome.
How you doing? I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Doing great here. Looking forward to getting a chance to dig into your basketball journey, learn a little bit about more about how you've built two successful high school programs out there in the state of California.
I appreciate it.
Want to start out by talking about how you got into the game of basketball as a kid. So give us a little background on how you first fell in love with basketball.
Okay, sounds good. I want to say it was kind of a twofold answer, I guess, to that question. The first one, I was always big, always tall. You know, I remember kindergarten pictures of the next tallest person came up to my elbows, and you know, I was always that funny looking tall kid that everyone
saw.
So I think, you know, being a tall kid, you're typecasted into doing that. You can't be a jockey or a golfer. You got to be a basketball player, right? So that was part of getting into basketball, was just you know, kind of born into it, is what I always like to say. And the other part was I had an older brother who loved basketball, played basketball, and we had one of those streets that unfortunately, kids, for the most part, don't understand anymore where when it was 4 o'clock and homework was done, our streets shut down and people were playing over-the-line baseball and basketball and rollerblading and any and every sport you could imagine. And basketball is probably our biggest one. So I just kind of fell in love with it because everyone in our community did it. And, you know, from a young age, I would run outside as soon as I finished my homework and get after it. So that's kind of how my passion started for the game.
How do you think that background of playing a lot of, I'm just going to use the term pickup sports, mm-hmm. but I think that's probably even too formal. Your background sounds a lot like mine, where you're just out in the street playing just everything. Mm-hmm. How do you think that impacted you as an athlete? And then how do you think that impacts your thoughts towards multi-sport athletes as a coach?
I think it impacted it a lot, you know, because I feel like kids today, every game is pressurized, you know. They could be in a game where they're playing and it's a Sunday morning. It doesn't mean much and they're playing a game and, you know, mom and dad are upset because they're paying a lot of money for the kid to play and he's not playing a lot or he's not scoring a lot or, you know, now you're putting a lot of pressure on the kid and it doesn't become fun. Where we were outside, there was no parents out there. You know, we were just with us with my brothers and the people on our street. And if you lost, you know, you maybe had to wait a couple games, but, you know, there wasn't people behind you kind of getting mad at you for doing the wrong things and coaches telling you what to do. So you really got able to fall in love with it. And you really didn't have that scrutiny that I think a lot of kids do now, which made it fun, you know, and I think that's part of it. I think the other part being was community, you know, and everyone likes having friends and, you know, we had older kids and younger kids and girls and boys and you got to kind of bond with everybody in your area. So, you know, you get a little bit of sense of community and as a young kid, that's also a great thing.
Yeah, I think there's two points there that I really agree with you on 100%. And, you know, the first one is there, what you mentioned about playing against kids of different ages. Mm-hmm. I think that's such a thing that kids in today's basketball system very rarely get an opportunity to do that. And I feel like for me as a player and for people in my era, and I'm going to turn 50 here in a couple of days, mm-hmm. you know, that's how you got better. You were at the playground, you were out in the driveway, you were playing against neighbors who are 4 years older than you, or you were playing with adults when you were 15 and guys are pushing you around. And mm-hmm. I think that really helps to develop skills in a different way than today's system does. And then the second part of that, which I think is something that a lot of people don't think about it, and I'm glad you brought it to our attention, is the fact that almost every game now that a kid plays, and we're not just talking about basketball here, we're talking about every single sport.
Right.
Mom and dad or somebody, a coach, an adult, somebody is there observing that kid's performance. And then we all know that in most cases, getting critiqued in the car on the way home mm-hmm. or at dinner or whatever. Mm-hmm. And there's very little opportunity for kids to experiment or try things that maybe they're not good at because they don't want to look bad in front of these adults who are giving them feedback on what they're doing. I think that's a really underrated part of a kid's development. I know that for me, I would not have wanted to play every single game with somebody watching me. I think about the number of times I went and played in a pickup game where maybe the talent level wasn't super high. Mm-hmm. And I said to myself, all right, this game, I'm only going to dribble with my left hand or I'm only going to try to pass this game. And you could never do that now in the current system where you're playing in a gym with officials and mom and dad watching. I think those are two, for sure, underrated things about how players developed previously compared to how they develop today.
Right. I agree with that. I also think, too, it's a financial thing. You know, I was, as sad as it is, always goes back to money. Pickup was free. You know, you didn't have to pay. And if you lost, you didn't hurt anyone's bank account because you lost. And, you know, now it's parents are paying an inordinate amount of money to play AAU and club and park leagues and all these stuff that they got to pay for. And, you know, parents want to return on their money. They want to see their kids and they want to see, you know, getting better and improving and playing. And that leads to frustration, which leads to pressure, which leads to putting it on the kid.
So absolutely.
There's a lot of that too. And the second thing is, I just want to wish you happy birthday. That's awesome.
Oh, thank you. Huh? Yeah, appreciate it. Yeah, nice. I'm getting there, man. Big 5-0. I'm almost there. So probably by the time this comes out, I'll be across the threshold.
Well,
so
enjoy your last couple of days in your 40s.
Absolutely, man. It's amazing. I'm sure you feel the same way. But the number that goes next to your age never, I don't think you ever feel what that number is. Once you get past about 25, it's kind of like, yeah, that number doesn't look right. It just doesn't sit well. So at any rate, that's coming probably too quick, but hopefully whatever time I have left will be as good as the first 50. Good. Let's put it that way. All right. So I wanted to ask you, as what we just talked about there in terms of the development of players, we're going to kind of jump ahead and then we'll swing back to talk more about your playing days. But I wanted to ask you, just based off what we just said, how does what we talked about impact you as a high school coach and the players that you have coming up through your program? Do you see things that you attribute to sort of the difference in how players grew up in the era when you were playing versus the players now? And just what are some of the good things that you see about the system today? And then what are some things that you think maybe are impacted negatively by what we just described?
Right. I think, you know, there's a lot of positives, a lot of negatives. Negatives, I'll start with first. I think the social media is an issue. You know, it does us so much good, but it also does so much bad. We had a game a couple years ago, and, you know, we're big on taking charges and things like that, and had a kid who was in the right spot, rotated correctly. Guy went up to dunk it, and he just jumped out of the way. And I said, "What are you doing, man? You know, you're there to take a charge." He said, "Coach, that's a business decision." And I said, "Business decision?" And he goes, "Coach, I don't want to be on YouTube. Like, I don't want that." You know, where we didn't have that fear in high school.
For sure.
You know, we didn't have that fear of being on YouTube and being embarrassed, or being on Snapchat and all your friends are talking about it. And so, you know, social media causes a lot of those negatives that I think are unfair to kids, and it kind of hurts the coaches. You know, I think there's a lot of, now every game is amplified, going back to that. There's a lot of that in the basketball world, where you'll have a kid who'll score 40 and the next night he'll score 10, and he's upset and his parents are upset and everyone doesn't understand why, and it's someone else's fault. So you get a lot of that, you know, pressure on every game, where, you know, you look at Damian Lillard, who scores 45, and then, you know, next night he scores 10, he's 3 for 25, and he's not stressed out about it or upset. But it seems like, you know, in high school, everything's magnified, just because there's so much money potentially on the line with college, and you know, eventually if they get to that point where they can play and make some money playing hoops.
For sure.
You know, and then the positive side, I think there's a lot of great stuff going on in basketball. I think we've kind of hit a threshold where things are starting to turn. People are starting to see the ugly side of basketball. A lot of the ugly side's coming out. And now we're starting to get back to a little bit more of the pure side of basketball, I think, with a little bit of the stuff, you know, the USA Basketball is doing, and a lot of the, you know, the AAU stuff's kind of starting to get cleaned up a little bit. I think kids are starting to have more of a choice and a voice, which is great. I love that. You know, I love being on social media and seeing the positive stuff, where kids can talk about the good stuff they're doing, the good stuff their teams are doing, you know, the good stuff they're doing in the classrooms, and they get to promote and boast and do all that, which is great, you know. So you get both sides of kind of that era.
Let me ask you about the skill level of today's players compared to, let's say, just when you started coaching. Mm-hmm. How do you feel that the skill level, just overall, from a, let's say, player 1 through 12 on a high school roster, how would you compare their skill level to maybe the kids when you first started? Obviously, you know, you're looking at just your specific program, but just in general, what you see out there, high schools across, the people that are on your schedule and the teams that you're familiar with, how would you compare the skill level now to when you first started?
That's a good question. We always talk about, as a staff, we talk about the pretty skills. The pretty skills have gotten better. You know, the fancy ball handling is way better than what it was when I was playing.
For sure.
The shooting is at a higher rate, I'd say, from player 1 through 10 on your team. Where back in the, you know, when I was playing, it was, you know, you had a couple guys that can really shoot it, but now, you know, you got pretty much a lot. Every kid can shoot it, you know, unless they're a kid coming from a football team or a, you know, a guy like that, and they're playing year round. They pretty much can shoot it at a decent clip. So a lot of those pretty skills are getting better. I think they're better than what it was. But I think the finer skills, and the skills that win you games, the box outs, the setting screens, the footwork, you know, jump stops, you know, all the stuff that the real coaches know, you know, will win you the games in March and February, and those kind of things are getting worse, you know, just because, you know, parents are, again, going back to financial, but parents are paying money for trainers. And, you know, we always joke about, there's no defensive trainers out there, there's only offensive trainers. You know, there's no one teaching kids how to set a screen in a training workout. You know, parents don't want to pay for stuff like that. They want to see their kid dribble and put it on Instagram and all that stuff. So the pretty stuff is there, but the ugly stuff that wins games is kind of lacking.
How about IQ? What do you see in terms of basketball IQ across the board?
I think it's going up. You know, people say it's going down. I think there's a lot more good. You know, kids have so much. They're so lucky. They can go on a computer and type in any type of basketball skill or any type of basketball breakdown and get something. You know, and they can find ways to watch their games and watch other people's games and rewind stuff and make highlight clips. And, you know, that is such an advantage that I'd never had. You know, we were VHS rewinding and, you know, doing all that stuff.
Missing the clip by 30 seconds and then having to replay it 12 times to get to it.
Yeah.
I remember those days.
So it faded and you couldn't really watch it anymore. And, you know, they don't have to deal with all that. So they have access to so much information that we didn't have. So they do get to have a huge advantage with that aspect.
All right. So let's jump back from that discussion and go back to you as a kid and revisit just the time when you started to take basketball a little bit more seriously. Do you remember what some of the things were that you did? Because obviously it was a different era where you didn't have access to all the things that you just described in terms of being able to go on and search YouTube and find drills and things to do. Mm-hmm. So when you started taking basketball a little bit more seriously, how did you go about improving yourself as a player back in the day?
It was just work, you know, and I've still taken that, I think, today. You know, I always tell kids, you know, when we do team workouts or individual workouts and things like that, my workouts are really boring. You know, they're just layups and they're different kinds of layups, but they're hundreds at a time, you know, and just repetitive. I always tell our guys, if you practice anything every day, you're going to get good at it. You know, thousands and thousands of reps. And I always say reps are the best teacher. You know, that's the best trainer and the best teacher. And that was kind of something I developed as a kid. I was going back to where I was living, I was on a street where I was the youngest kid also. So everyone was older than me. So if I didn't get better, I didn't play. You know, I had to sit down and watch. And, you know, I didn't want to do that. And I wanted to play with everybody. So I was one of the younger ones. So I had to get better. And I had to get better quick. So that came to just getting shots up and doing the little things and, you know, improving my spots. And, you know, and I always remember I have a neighbor who's actually a high school head coach as well now. My neighbor growing up, we were about 10 years old. I remember he said to me one time, and I'll never forget, he said, get really good at one thing. And that always stuck with me. So I try to get good at one thing and, you know, and then you find out later that's really true. If you get really good at one thing, a coach can find a way to use you.
That's so true. What'd you get good at?
Rebounding. That was my thing. To rebound. Everyone loves someone who rebounds. So
absolutely. There's no way to be a selfish rebounder,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. I always say you can dribble too much, you can shoot too much, but no one will ever get mad at you for rebounding too much.
That is for sure. There's no question about that. I think that's great advice for players out there and even for coaches when you're thinking about what do you want to do with a particular player. And we had Mike Procopio on, who has worked with the Mavericks, and he was in the news recently because he was Kobe's kind of game coach and would do scouting for him. And Mike's statement that he always puts out there is dominate simple. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's like guys in the NBA, you know, there's 25 guys that matter that get the number of shots that they want, get all the plays called for them. And everybody else is a role player. And everybody else has to figure out what they do. And you're talking about the very, very best players in the world, 350 of them never get a play called for them ever. You know, and here we have these high school kids who want to do a bazillion off the dribble moves and do all these other things. And he's just like, look, get good at one or two things that are really, really easy to execute, but you're doing them perfectly. And I think that goes right along with what you just said, that you know, if you can get good at one thing, coach is going to find a way. If you're the best defensive player, 100%. If you're the best rebounder, if you're the best passer, there's a spot for you. Coaches are going to find a way to get you in the game for sure.
Agreed.
Give me a memory from high school basketball, one or two things from when you were playing that stand out to you when you think back on your high school career. What's something that is going to stick with you for the rest of your life?
You know, I always said the first play of my high school career, I got literally the first play. I got dunked on by Tyson Chandler. And that was something that'll always stick with me, you know, because I realized, man, like I thought I was good. I was a freshman. You know, I thought I was a really, really good player. And I came out there and first play of the game, I got dunked on by, you know, eventually an NBA player, which made me feel a little bit better. But still, you know, it kind of stuck with me, like, you have a lot of work to do. And I think that always made me realize you always have a lot of work to do. You know, as soon as you get content, it seems like, in the world and in basketball especially, you know, you always have somebody knocking behind you, pushing you to make you better. And that was a real eye-opening. You know, in my little community, I was pretty good. But all of a sudden, we go out and we play against, you know, some real teams, and wow, you know, turn around.
You got video of that?
I don't. I hope it's burned and buried somewhere. But
do you have the mind's eye video in your head? Like, can you instantly call that up, what it looks like?
Yes, I may or may not have gone to therapy because of that one play. Yeah,
it's amazing. Like, it's funny because there's some I have some things as a player and as a coach. There's some things that you have that mind's eye view of what you saw in the moment. And then there's other, and a lot of it is, again, stuff that I don't have video of. And then there's things that I have video of. And because maybe I've seen that video, I tend to remember more of the video as opposed to kind of the mind's eye of what happened. So I always think it's interesting to how your memory, the further you get removed from it. If you have video, the video kind of steals your actual memory of the moment. So in a way, there's a couple things that I wish I didn't have video of, so I just could remember more of the feeling and the point of view from me when it was actually happening.
That's a good point. Anyway,
that's interesting. With Tyson Chandler. So did you play? Were they in your league, or was that a one-off game?
No, that was just a regular, you know, preseason game.
Gotcha.
You know, we had a good league. Nick Young was in my league. Jordan Farmar was in my league. So we had a good little league, you know, in its own right. But that was an eye-opening kind of experience for me as a player.
Gotcha. So at any point during your high school career, were you thinking about playing beyond high school? And just what did that look like for you? Because, again, there's a lot of players out there that listen to the podcast and just are trying to figure out how to navigate that situation. So maybe talk a little bit about you as a high school player and your thoughts about playing beyond high school.
Yep. So I started getting interest to play in college as like a sophomore. You know, I was 6'7" and played like a wing position. I wasn't like a back to the basket center. I really enjoyed rebounding, you know, average about 10 to 12 rebounds a game, and could shoot it a little bit from the outside, you know, and averaged about 12, 14 points a game, and kind of had a lot of schools interested at that level as sophomore. You know, got a little bit better and a little bit better, and things started to pick up a little bit. But I always knew from, you know, I started coaching my little brother when I was maybe about 14 years old. You know, just rec ball, youth ball stuff, started coaching. And as soon as I did it, I coached a couple games. I said, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. And that kind of turned a switch for me. So even when I was in high school, I told my high school coach, you know, I want to coach. Ended up going to UCSB, had some offers to play some D2 stuff, some D3 stuff, and went to UC Santa Barbara, and was an invited walk-on to play there, and ended up not really playing there just because I wanted to coach. Talked to a couple of their coaches, and they actually got me started and started doing some stuff coaching when I was there as a college student, doing some youth stuff and just trying to get better and learn. And that's kind of how my road kind of started.
All right, so what was it about coaching when you first started coaching your younger brother? What was it about coaching that grabbed you right away? Because I think I've said this now, it feels like with the last couple coaching interviews that we've done, that you either have two schools of thought with a coach. You have somebody who's kind of like yourself, that you're younger, and from the time you're a young player, you think, man, I can't wait till I get the opportunity to coach.
Yep.
I already know that's what I want to do. And then you have other people who – they're players, or they've been involved in the game, whatever, but coaching never really is on their radar until all of a sudden the playing stops.
Right.
Like, you know, I still want to be involved in the game. Now I got to go figure out how to do that. And then that's where they get to coaching. So what was it about coaching right from the beginning that grabbed you? What did you love about the process?
You know, I'm big on just the service aspect of it, you know, and how you're helping people. I remember, you know, one time it was a Park and Rec game. I was, like I said, I was probably 14 years old, you know, coaching a youth team with my brother on it. And I drew up a play with 10 seconds left, and we got a layup exactly how we drew it up, you know, probably the first and last time that actually worked. But, you know, I drew up a play and it worked, and seeing the kids' satisfaction jumping up and down, and the parents, and everyone was so happy. And, you know, for me, that was really, really rewarding. You know, I've always been brought up in a family to serve and help others and, you know, put others before you. And, you know, I think just having that aspect of it My mom was a school teacher. She helped helped special needs kids, did that for 20 plus years. So I think I got a lot of that from her, just wanting to help and find ways to make people happy. And I thought, you know, coaching was that vehicle for me to make that happen.
And so did you know from the time you started that high school was the level that you wanted to coach? Did you entertain any thoughts of trying to get into college coaching right out of the gate, especially since you had some contact with the coaches at UCSB?
Yep.
Just explain maybe the process about how you ended up at the level where you are now.
I mean, I think everyone dreams of, you know, being the Lakers head coach, or, you know, at least in LA guys, you know, that's what you want to do, or, you know, being the Knicks head coach or whatever the case may be. But, you know, I thought that aspect of being a high school coach is fantastic because you're really, really hands-on. You know, for the most part, those kids are yours for 4 years. You get to really mold them in a lot more ways than just the X's and O's on the court. You know, you're there for them and through their good times and bad times, and you're there for them off the court, and you're doing team meals and bus rides and all the stuff that you remember as a player, and you get to make those memories for them as great as possible. And, you know, I've had opportunities to you know, coach in college and different places, and not saying I never would do it. You know, I definitely would be open to an opportunity if it was the right one, but I'm not, I really enjoy where I'm at. I really enjoy the high school level because I think you really have that hands-on experience that, you know, I'm sure a lot of college coaches have, but I feel like in high school, it's such an important time for these young men in my aspect, but young men and women to grow and mature and be, you know, eventually, you know, good parts of society and those that help can make this world a better place.
Absolutely. All right. So two questions that come to mind off of what you just said. One is, and you sort of mentioned it here, but let's go into a little bit more detail about how you build those relationships with your players that you're describing, where it's bus trips, it's team meals. How do you go about developing the kind of relationship where you can then have that impact on their lives that you clearly want to have?
Yep. I think it's, you know, it all starts with love. You know, I always say love is the most amazing thing in the world, and everyone wants it and everyone can give it. And, you know, I think as a coach, it's extremely important to do both of those things. You know, every kid wants to feel important. Every kid wants to feel respected. Every kid wants to, you know, be shown some love. And, you know, I always try to make sure I'm there at practice 30, 45 minutes early and calling certain kids in. Hey, man, how's your day? What's going on? You know, talking about real life and forget basketball for a couple minutes. And when practice is over, I try to stay for a certain amount of time, not every day, but most days, and sit down and talk to them, play some horse with them, and, you know, just mess around and have someone they can kind of trust and be a part of. And I think once you start that with the coaches, you kind of start with that love aspect, you know, and they love you and they understand that you love them. They'll run through a wall for you, you know, and then you can start building the culture through the players and start building up, you know, more relationships, and I think it just kind of grows from there. But that's definitely the starting factor for me, is just understand that you have their back, you know, and that they have someone that they can trust in you, and you're always there for them.
So would you say that those relationships and those conversations are done more on an informal basis, as opposed to you saying, okay, we're scheduling a meeting once a week or every month that we're checking in? Or would you say it's more of an informal process, kind of a day-to-day, just as opportunities present themselves? And obviously you're putting yourself in position to be able to have those opportunities present themselves.
Yep. You know, we do a little bit of both. So I have, each year I have four assistants. I'm really lucky. I have four assistant coaches, and, you know, I give those, I chop up our players into, you know, groups where each assistant has about three or four guys that they're kind of in charge of checking with each week. Whether it's a text, whether it's a phone call, whether it's just a, you know, in practice while they're stretching, go over and sit down and talk to them while they're stretching, just to make sure that they're good. And then I try to check in with everybody every week, every couple weeks, just to make sure that they're doing, you know, that they're doing okay. You know, the other thing is just, I tell coaches too, is be aware. You know, kid shows up late, you know, kid shows up, you know, looks like he's out of it a little bit. You know, don't just jump to conclusions. You know, you're late, everyone on the line, you know. Kids have a lot of stuff going on in their lives, and, you know, maybe pull them to your office first. Hey, man, you all right? What's going on? And see where they're at before just, you know, kind of jumping to conclusions and being that guy that nobody wants to be around, because they're just, you know, it's either your way or the highway.
Yeah, I think that's something that has definitely changed over the last 30 years of coaching, for sure. Not that there wasn't that mentality existing back 30 years ago, but it certainly was far, far less prevalent than it is today. It's amazing the number of coaches that we've talked to that have shared that same sentiment that you just shared, which is, I got to know my guys. I got to know the girls on my team. Mm-hmm. And when I do that, then I'm much better able to enforce the culture, for lack of a better way of saying it. Because if everything is just, you're late, all right, everybody on the line, or you're late, you know, you're not going to start the next game, this and that, and there's no understanding of what the situation is. And I can speak to it as, it's funny because as a parent, you sort of see things on the other side, because for a long time, I was a player. Then for a long time, I was a coach with no kids. And before that, I was a coach with no wife. And so when you're a coach with no wife and no kids, and you're coming off fairly recently being a player, you have no concept of the time constraints on someone who has a family and other siblings and places, people to get. And it's funny because I think back to when I first started coaching, I was my second job was an assistant varsity coach at the school where I still teach. And we had a very young staff. We actually ended up staying together as a staff with the same group and the same positions for, I think we were together for 13 years, maybe. So it was kind of, I mean, it was just, just three great guys that all of us got along, and it was amazing. But we would go at the beginning when I first started. So I was 25. I think our head coach was maybe 31. And then our assistant was like 20. Our JV coach was like 22. And we would literally practice in the preseason. Like, we'd have a 3.5 hour practice, and then we'd sit in the coach's office for another 2-3 hours after that talking. And I think back to that now. And one, the value of a 3.5 hour practice. I mean, I can't imagine we were getting anything out of those kids after like hour. Clearly after hour two, we were getting nothing. So diminishing returns. But I know, and I think back to that time, and we'd say practices after school, but there was never, like, I'd never remember us putting an ending time on the practice schedule. And now I think about that as a parent, and I'm like, and that was almost like, that was just, this was like maybe 1995, 96. So you were just on the cusp of cell phones and all this. I can't even imagine how annoying it had to have been a parent on one of those teams, and like never knowing when your kid's going to be done. And how, just, oh, I can't even imagine. And now clearly it's, you know, it's a lot, things are a lot different.
That's funny. Yeah, you're 100% right. You know, I think that things have changed a lot, you know, and I think the way kids are, you know, people always complain this generation, this and just this generation, that, and but this generation actually does a lot of really good things too. And they're special in a lot of ways that you know, that I think people don't recognize. So I think we got to play both sides of it.
Head Start Basketball, along with members of the Jay Billis Skills Camp staff, will be hosting the very first Prime Skills Camp, an affiliate of the Jay Billis Skills Camp that is held annually in Charlotte, North Carolina. Prime Skills Camp will take place on the campus of Western Reserve Academy, just outside of Cleveland, Ohio, June 26th through the 28th, and will be designed for boys rising to grades 6 through 9. Prime Skills Camp will mirror the Jay Billis Skills Camp in daily programming, teaching, coach-to-camper ratio, and quality of instruction. Prime Skills Camp brings all of the team-oriented individual instruction, focus on the fundamentals, and high-level coaching to young men aspiring to a high school varsity basketball experience. This camp is operated by Billis Camp veterans and includes the Jay Billis Coaches Development Program alongside the camp, ensuring that the quality of teaching and coaching at this camp is second to none. Please visit headstartbasketball.com or jbilliscamp.com for more information or to get registered.
What are some of those things that you love about the kids that you coach now, this generation? What are some things that you think that they do really well that are maybe sometimes underrated by those people that are saying, oh, kids today?
Yeah. You know, I think they have a voice, which is awesome. You know, where I think, you know, a lot of people, at least in my generation, were scared of their high school coach. You know, he or she was a, you know, powerful, loud, and they had an opinion. You know, they had their opinion, and that was the, like I said, my way or the highway. You know, I'll have kids on my team, like, you know, come up to me after practice, like, coach, you know, I don't think we understood that. You know, like, at least I didn't.
Right.
And to have a kid be able to say something like that is pretty cool. You know, I think
could you have imagined ever saying that to your high school or college coach? I could never imagine having said that.
Zero chance. And in all reality, like, I wish, you know, people would be that understanding to you know, and or at least have that passion to go say something to their coach, because
right.
I probably would have learned a lot better, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Instead of just going out there and pretending like I knew what I was doing, you know, when we in all reality we probably didn't, because he didn't explain it well enough.
True.
So, you know, the other side of it too is the technology. You know, they're, you know, I think I'm pretty good with technology, and I have, you know, my house is all Alexa, and I've got the vacuum robot and all the technology nice. Stuff, but, you know, they are unbelievable with that stuff, and I'm always asking them stuff and questions, and we had drones at practice a couple months ago, and just the cool stuff that they know how to do. You know, it makes it fun for them, and, you know, I think it really helps their game in some ways, you know, having all that technology, so.
They definitely have more access, like we talked about earlier, to be able to see
yep.
whether it's their own game film, whether it's opponent's game film, whether it's just the opportunity to go and say, hey, I want to pull up whatever, my favorite NBA player, and look at the things that they do and the footwork and all that stuff. The access that kids have, I think one of the interesting things, and this kind of goes back to the question I asked you about how you improved and got better. I think mm-hmm. about myself, again, as a player, and I did basically – I had a workout that I did when I shot – by myself,
right?
That stayed the same probably from the time I was 15 until the time I was done playing in college at age 22.
Yep.
And then I had one other workout that I did if I had a partner to shoot with.
Right.
And other than that, like yep. I did those same yep. drill, the exact same thing from age 14 to age 22. I never varied any of it.
Right.
And now you think about the amount of player development information that's out there, and the things that you can do to improve yourself as right. a player are just incredible. And I would have been a kid who would have eaten that stuff up.
Me too.
And at the time, like, I just, you know, again, I only knew what I knew.
Right. Right. It's a really good point. Yeah. You know, I remember eventually they started coming out with VHSs of like training stuff and those championship right. productions. And but that was, I think it was a little past, you know, when I was, you know,
the Steve Alford workout tapes.
Yep. Yep. Exactly. Exactly. So,
yeah. All right. So let's move backwards to your first coaching job out of school. Talk to me a little bit about that and what your first experience was kind of with a formal coaching job as opposed to sort of a youth coaching job.
Right. So I was at Santa Barbara, you know, doing my youth stuff. And the coach at my alma mater, where I played, was Alex Lopez, who's actually the older brother to Brooke and Robin Lopez.
Okay.
And he was the coach. He didn't coach me, but he was there when, you know, he was there for a stint. And I got a call from the athletic director, said, "Hey, I heard you're coaching. You know, our coach Alex Lopez is, you know, doing a lot of stuff with his brothers," because this was the time when they were at Stanford and they were deciding if they were going to go on the draft and what they were going to do and all that stuff. So he called me and said, "Hey, he has no assistants. He needs someone that we can trust who can run a practice when he's not there. You know, if they're going to a draft combine or they're doing something, he wants to go with them. So we just need someone to be around." And I said, "You know, this is an opportunity I can't pass up." So I transferred to colleges to a local college around us, Cal State Northridge, and was his assistant. Ended up kind of, you know, he kind of had his priorities with those two guys, and kind of took the helm a little bit for a while, and, you know, loved it, and did about a half a season, you know, over there helping out, and then kind of a half a season, you know, being in charge. And that was my first job. And then that kind of transpired into job two, which was, we actually played at a school called Chaminade High School where I got my second job. We played, and I saw a guy that was their head coach, who I kind of knew. And he said, "Hey, I didn't know you were coaching, and I didn't know you were interested in this." And then we kind of connected, and he said, "Hey, you know, I don't know how long I'm going to be doing this for, and continue to do this. You know, I have a couple of young kids, so if you want to be my JV coach for a couple of years and learn how to, you know, be a private school head coach and all the stuff that you would want to learn, you know, I'll take you and do everything. I'll bring you to every meeting. I'll show you how I do every piece of paperwork. I'll show you every parent meeting you can sit in, every player meeting you can sit in, and just really learn if this is something you want to do." Kind of took me under his wing for that. And he ended up leaving after the first year, and which was unexpected. And 3 months later, I interviewed and got the job as the head coach at 22 years old. And kind of didn't really know too much what I was doing, but when you get thrown in the fire, sometimes it's a good thing.
So what was the transition like from being a JV coach / assistant to taking over the program? What were some of the adjustments that you had to make initially right out of the gate? And I'm sure we could go back and say, what did you learn over the course of time from then until now? But let's start with just what were the initial adjustments from going from being an assistant to being in charge?
You know, your role changes drastically. You know, I think as an assistant coach, you know, I'm not saying, like, you know, as an assistant coach, you can be more of the good cop. You know, I was the guy when you know, he subbed somebody out and that guy was frustrated, I'd run over and, you know, hey, keep your head up, you know, this and that. You know, I really didn't do too much coaching in terms of, you know, everyone get on the line, or, you know, they didn't hate me yet to a certain extent in terms of all that stuff. So I got to be that kind of good cop, you know, and that role kind of had to change quick. You know, so I always tell my guys, I'm gonna love you when practice is before practice, I'm gonna love you after practice. We're gonna be close and we're gonna joke around, we're gonna have a great time. But as soon as that whistle starts and as soon as that whistle ends, you know, in between those lines, you know, you're not gonna like me for a while, which is fine. I think the best coaches are the best teachers during that time, and the ones that can push their players during that time and try to get them out of their comfort zones and all those things. So you know, that had to change for me, was just kind of changing that role of being that guy who everyone loved and everyone, you know, got along with all the time to, you know, during those 2 hours of practice, you know, you're not going to like what we're doing all the time. So.
Did you realize that right out of the gate? I mean, did you come in with that knowledge that that was going to be a change, or was that something that dawned on you slowly over time? How did you gain that knowledge that was going to happen?
Yep. Well, I thought, you know, initially I was I'm just going to do the same thing I've been doing. And that didn't didn't last quick. You know, you realize quick as a coach, you know, you can't be that same person, that same voice. You got to change pretty quickly. So, you know, they were kind of walking all over me early. You know, I was 22, they were 18. So that was already an issue. And then, you know, you add the fact that I was being Mr. Nice Guy and trying to please everybody and, you know, trying to be that nice cop. Even during practice time, you know, it was a quick rude awakening for me. Like, you know, I got to change how I am. So, you know, I think over time and after realizing and trial and error, you know, you realize you got to change your voice and you got to change the way you are and, you know, what works and what doesn't. And you got to learn and kind of be humble. I think a lot of coaches, you know, they always say it's my way for the highway for the players, but I think you got to take that as yourself as well. You know, if something's not working, you know, instead of blaming somebody else, you got to look in the mirror and figure out for yourself how you can change.
Yeah, I think that's great advice for you. Yeah, that's great advice for young coaches.
Yep.
And I think especially young coaches who have been players or had successful playing careers, and I can speak to this myself. Mm-hmm. I think when you come off of a playing career and you come into coaching and you think that just because you knew how to play, mm-hmm. that you can be a good coach, and it's very easy to get stuck in, come on, I know what I'm saying. I've been playing this game since I was a kid, and I played at such and such a level, and you should listen to me because I got all this knowledge from being a player.
Right.
And I look back on me as a 22, 23-year-old and thought that I knew everything.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm almost 50 and realize that I don't know anything.
Correct.
And that 100%. There's so much out there in the game to learn. And I wish I had had that same knowledge about what I didn't know back when I was 22. I would have ended up being a much better coach, and I'm sure been able to have a lot greater impact on the kids that I was fortunate enough to have as players on different teams that I coached over the years. But it's just interesting, I think, that your perspective, the longer you're in it and the more you get exposed to different thoughts and ideas, the more you realize that you know very little. And I think that for players, especially who are transitioning into coaching, a lot of times the only knowledge of coaching you have is the people that coached you.
Correct.
Because it's not like you're a high school player and you're like, all right, I'm going to go and check out how the neighboring high school practice runs, and I'm going to go to this coaching clinic. All you know is what your high school coach did. And then for me, who played in college, you only know what your college coach did. So when I ran a practice, guess what I was doing?
Right.
What those two guys did.
Correct.
I didn't know anything else. And so you just look at it and you're like, man, there's just such a fountain of knowledge out there that you can tap into, especially today. It's even easier than it was back when you or I started, for sure.
Yep. And I think the other thing too, a lot of, you know, young coaches don't realize is there's a lot more to coaching than just coaching. You know, I always say I spend probably 90% of my day doing the other things. the paperwork, the emails, the organizations, the calendars, the bus schedules, the team. I mean, there's so much more to coaching than actually just being on the court. And I think a lot of young coaches, you know, especially lower level coaches, they kind of just show up and everything's kind of done. They don't realize there's a lot you got to do as a coach besides the actual coaching part.
So as a head coach, let's ask you this question. Mm-hmm. What were one or two things that when you got the head job that you had to do that you didn't realize going into it? What? I got to do that. I got to spend time on that. What were some things that surprised you from that aspect?
You know, I think a lot of it was, you don't realize how involved parents are. I think that was one of them. You know, you really don't realize, you know, when you're a lower level coach, a lot of things get put on the varsity coach's plate, you know, the head of the program's plate. So you don't realize, you know, how involved parents are. And especially, you know, I worked at a pretty affluent Catholic private school where, you know, parents are paying a lot of money for their kid to go to school there. So they expect a lot of things. They expect good coaching. They expect playing time. They expect uniforms that, you know, to be new. And, you know, they expect a lot of things if they're paying all that money. So you don't realize how involved parents are, which is good and bad. You know, I always say parents can make coaches' life fantastic. They can also make it very, very difficult. You know, and I think that's one thing young coaches got to realize is that's a big part of it. The second thing is the paperwork. You know, not only from like the liability stuff, you know, you got to realize there's a lot of liability stuff that I didn't, you know, when you're a young coach, you don't realize. And then just the paperwork side of it is there's so much stuff you have to do all the time. Whether it's forms or medical forms or, you know, there's insurance forms for everything. You know, you want to go shoot at someone else's gym, you got to fill out 9 forms, provide proof of insurance, and you want to use a different bus company. You got, you know, forms and insurances, and, you know, you want to drive a kid in a van. You know, there's so much you have to do that I think young coaches, you don't realize there's a lot more besides just coaching.
Yeah, you better be organized, right?
100%. 100%.
All right. So you mentioned parents. Let's go there. Mm-hmm. Talk to me a little bit about what you do to engage parents with your program, to make sure that they're on board, to make sure that they feel valued as part of what you're doing. And therefore, obviously, when you have those parents that are supportive and engaged with your program, they're much more likely to be supportive of what their kid is bringing home with them from the basketball program. So just talk about how you engage parents.
Yep. You know, I always say it's a four-way street with parents. You know, it takes four of us in order to get your kid to where we want him to go. It takes the coach, it takes the parents, it takes the player, and it takes the administration. And if those four things aren't together, you know, it's going to be hard for your kid to be, you know, successful in a lot of ways. So we need all four of those things to make this kid's experience and his time at our school and for him to achieve his goals to make those work. And, you know, I think if you use that approach, like parents are with you. And I tell parents all the time, I want to be with you, you know, but you got to be with me. And, you know, we all got to be on the same team. And if there's a problem, you know, as long as it's not an everyday occurrence and as long as you understand, your kid understands, you know, let's figure it out. You know, I want to make sure everybody's happy and all that. I think a lot of that, which I think my staff does a good job of is, and our school does a good job of, is just defining kids' roles, you know, early before the season starts. You know, these are our guys and you know, you might want to be on the team. You're probably our 10th guy as of right now. It doesn't mean you can't be our 6th eventually, but, you know, as of right now, you're our 10th and here's where you stand, and letting the parents know that, you know, hey, your son, your daughter might not play, and are you okay with that? If not, you know, there might be a different route you might want to go, but here's, you know, just kind of being clear and transparent with them so you kind of avoid any problems before they actually happen.
Yeah, I think that proactive communication in anything, whether I'm sure you as a teacher do the same thing, mm-hmm. as a coach, it's clear that when you establish a relationship beforehand and you have these conversations before the season begins, before problems arise,
correct.
Then people are going to be a lot more receptive, just like you talked about building a relationship with the kid.
Correct.
When you build a relationship with the parent prior to the problem occurring, it becomes a lot easier to have that difficult conversation when you've already had 5 or 6 positive conversations, as opposed to the first time they hear from you or the first time you hear from them is when little Johnny isn't playing mm-hmm. as much as they think he or she should. And I think that's where, again, a lot of young coaches sometimes make that mistake of they don't proactively engage parents.
Right.
And then when problems do arise, there's no relationship to fall back on where you can say, hey, I've done X, Y, and Z, and this is the communication we've had, and here's what I'm doing for your kid. Instead, it just becomes this adversarial relationship. And that's where you run into trouble.
Correct. 100%. 100%.
Do you guys have a formal parent meeting prior to the season? Mm-hmm. Is there anything? Just explain to me a little bit about the sort of the formal program that you put together and what that entails.
So I'm blessed to work at an unbelievable high school. You know, I really feel like I'm at one of the best places in the state of California, if not United States, in terms of how they do things. They actually do a parent meeting for all parents in the entire school. Anyone that's interested in athletics, you have to be there in order for your son to play. And our principal, our president, you know, get up there, and our athletic director, and they talk about how to deal with our coaches and formal lines of communication and what's okay and what's not and what we're yelling in the stands and what's not. And, you know, we'll come in the stands and remove you if you want to yell at our coach, and, you know, we'll ask you to leave if you want to yell at officials. And here's how we do it. If you don't like it, there's 670 other schools in Southern California. You're more than welcome to transfer to one of those. And a lot of schools, especially private schools, aren't like that. You know, they want to, you know, kind of cater to everybody and do everything, you know. And our school is pretty blunt and frank about, you know, here's how we do things. You know, we're going to do it the right way. And we have the confidence in ourselves that since we do things the right way, and since we feel that, you know, we're holding our families to a higher standard, that people are actually going to want that and not run from it. You know, where a lot of, you know, parents, you're going to schools and it's, you know, parents are yelling at the refs and yelling at the coaches, and they don't want to be a part of that anymore, where we feel we can handle that there. So that's one thing our school does great, is they do an all parent meeting, and then we have to do mandatory, which I would do anyways, our own basketball meeting with just the basketball parents. So we do one for each level, where we go through our rules and our standards and what we expect, you know, how we're going to communicate. You know, if your son's upset about his playing time, here's how I'd like you to go about it. You know, and if your son's upset about something else, here's how we'd like you to go about it, just to kind of make things pretty clear from the jump.
I think that's awesome that the athletic department and the school themselves take that, I don't want to say burden, but they just take that upon themselves to be able to establish some ground rules. Because one of the things that I find to be interesting, frustrating, in places that I've seen guys, that friends of mine that coach in different places, is you'll have situations that will arise that seem like they could just be taken care of by an athletic department policy of, look, this is our policy, this is the way we do things, and this is a clear violation of that policy. And instead, too often I see where it's left to this mushy kind of, oh, maybe, I'm not sure. And then it's put on each individual coach to kind of enforce these mushy rules that you don't know. Right. And one of the things that I love that you said earlier is that you have to have administration as sort of that fourth piece. You know, that's a piece of a coach being able to be successful, is having 100%. A good administration that understands what it takes in order to build a successful program. And in so many places I see where the coach has their standards, they've explained those standards to parents, to players, and then suddenly when that standard is violated, the athletic department or the school or whatever it is, the district, doesn't always support the coach's policies or what the decision that the coach has made, even though the decision is clearly, it's clearly been communicated prior to. And I think when you have a good, strong administration that supports coaches, and again, gets out in front of it, not just putting out fires when they happen, but gets out in front of it. To me, that's so important as far as having a good job as a high school,
I 100% agree. I've said, you know, one of the things I think I've learned now and doing this a while now is your administration is almost better than your players. You know, the better the administration, you know, the better you can be as a coach. You know, I was, you know, when you're fearing every day of practice, whether you're going to do something wrong or what parent you're going to make upset, and is your administration going to bring you into a meeting and talk about it? I mean, that's no way to coach. You know, you got to have, as a coach, you got to know your administration has your back. And, you know, at least mine here, you know, at St. Francis, always said, you know, we have your back. You know, I remember coming in the first year, I was, hey, can I do this? Hey, can I, you know, hey, we hired you to coach, like, do it your way. And that was really, really refreshing, you know, to hear. And, you know, I feel really, really blessed to be in a place like that.
Absolutely. Cause it's certainly not that way everywhere. We had Dave Severns on from the Clippers, I don't know, maybe 6 weeks ago or so. And Dave gave us his top 10 mistakes that high school coaches make, and his number one thing was take a bad job.
Yep.
And his biggest definition of a bad job is you have a bad administration.
Yep, it's a really good point.
And when you have a bad administration, it's very, very difficult to be able to build the kind of program that you want to build if you're not able to do the things that you believe in and that you think are true, and you're not going to be supported by that. And I think that's it's a huge piece of, I think, having success. All right, I want to ask you about putting together a coaching staff.
Mm-hmm.
So let's start back with when you first get the job at Chaminade, yep. How you put together a staff as a young coach, and then maybe how that has changed or developed over time as you've been in the profession longer, made more connections, just to how you, then maybe how you put together your current staff at St. Francis.
Yep. You know, first when I was there at Chaminade, my first year, it was, you know, I was kind of new in the basketball coaching world. So I put out a little advertisement, and we have our state, athletics website. So you put up a thing that says, Chaminade's looking for coaches, and if anyone's interested, email your resume. And I remember interviewing people. And first thing was, you're the head coach. I'm 22 years old, and older, older coaches, they're like, I don't want to work. I apologize, coach. I didn't know. They don't want to work for me,
right?
So you kind of had to realize quick who was your audience would be. And I had a buddy of mine who was a successful high school head coach, and he told me something that's always stuck. And he said, it's better to have people you trust than people who know the game. And that really stuck with me. And I didn't think so. Hey, I need somebody that can run my offense. I need someone that knows, next is an old guy. And yeah, sure, you do. But you need people you can trust more importantly than anything. I think that's something I've learned. It's just finding good people. Finding good people that you can trust. You don't want to go out, when the game's over and everyone's, walking on the court and talking, you don't want to have coaches that are saying, I'd play your son if I was the head coach, and and don't have your back in certain sense, in instances that aren't reliable, that don't care about the kids, that aren't out there and in it for the same reasons I am, just to give back and to be someone who can see these kids be successful, and all that stuff is way more important than the X's and O's, and so that was my big thing. And, that's definitely continued. I had the same staff for 9 years at Chaminade. One guy flipped eventually. He got a head job after year seven. But I had the same exact staff for 9 years, and I've had the same exact staff at St. Francis for five. And I think it's a testament to just hiring good people and just being around good people. I always say, we're going to have some bad times as a coach. We're going to have four losses in a row, and then we're on the road again, and it's going to be tough, and we're going to be looking for answers. At least surround yourself with people that you want to be around, that you can trust.
Absolutely.
That you can share a dialogue with, that are in it for the kids, and it makes coaching a lot better.
There's no question about that. I think back to, like I mentioned earlier, my time where we had the same staff for X number of years, and one of the things that you loved about it is whether times were good or whether times were bad, there was people that you loved to sit down with and talk and try to figure things out, whether you're figuring out, hey, what's working, or you're figuring out, hey, what's not working. And then long after the fact of the guy who was my head coach, who we're obviously still friends, but long after the time when we had coached together, he said to me, he goes, Mike, one of the things that the thing that I probably appreciated most about you when we were coaching together was your loyalty.
Right.
And to me, that was something that we never talked about when we were coaching together.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that he brought that up 10 years after we had coached together, to me, there was no greater compliment
that I could have been
paid. Like, it wasn't, hey man, I really love that press break you put in.
Right,
man,
you
were a wizard putting together baseline out of bounds plays.
Right.
It had nothing to do with that.
Right.
It's like exactly what you described, which is ultimately what matters is, you can teach somebody the X's and O's as a head coach. If you have somebody that you trust, you can help them to improve.
Correct.
And just like we talked about with a player.
Correct.
If you're a coach today and you don't know X's and O's very well, I mean, come on.
Yep.
You can get better at that, just by opening up your browser and getting on the computer and doing whatever it is that you want to do.
100%.
But you can't teach somebody to be a quality person who's going to have who's going to have loyalty. And, I've seen it in places where, as you said, there's a coach who's on the staff who is always publicly second guessing or is always campaigning secretly for the job of the head coach. And, you see those people, and they're ones that, from my perspective, then you always keep a distance from.
Yep, I'm with you.
Coaches, we've teamed up with Coach Tyler Whitcomb so you can now purchase his exclusive new playbooks right from the Hoopheads Pod website. If you're looking for ways to improve your team next season, these playbooks blend affordability with the quality content that serious coaches are looking for. Just visit hoopheadspod.com/store and you'll find playbooks from John Calipari of Kentucky, Leonard Hamilton from Florida State, and Mike Young of Virginia Tech. Check out these great resources at hoopheadspod.com/store.
As an assistant coach, I think being very transparent with your head coach, you know, and letting them know, you know, I had a coach last year that coached me and that, you know, I kind of wanted to hire. And he said to me, look, I want to be a head coach. That's something I want to do. You know, I want to help you as an assistant, but I want to be a head coach. I want you to help me, you know, learn, and I want you to help me find a job. And sure enough, he was with us 1 year, a job opened, and he's now a head coach. And, you know, I think just being that transparent with me was great because I knew from day one, you know, he wasn't out for my job, but, you know, it's also my job to help him since he's kind of helping our program.
Absolutely. So what are some things in that case, what are some things that you did maybe differently with him since he had clearly that ambition to go and be a head coach versus somebody who's mm-hmm. told you, hey, I'm in this for the long haul. I love being an assistant. I don't want to step up to that next chair.
Right.
What are maybe some things you would do differently in those two situations?
You know, I think with him, you know, the guy that wanted to be a head coach, you know, I was evident from day one is like, you need to be around and you need to, you know, you need to be around with all the office work and the meetings and understanding things. So I was always trying to explain to him, you know, stuff I wouldn't explain to all my assistants. You know, here's why I'm doing this. Here's why I'm doing this. Here's why we're leaving at this time. Here's why, you know, here's how you order the buses. And here's our guy that does our, you know, our uniforms. And, you know, we had a parent complaint. So now I want you in the meeting to learn and just kind of him understanding like what it takes to be that head coach. So he is prepared, you know, going back to what I said earlier about, you know, realizing it's not just the X's and O's, it's all the other stuff. So getting him in all those uncomfortable situations. And the other thing I did too, was I'd write a practice plan for him and I'd say, do you understand it? Yep. All right. You know, hey, go, you're the head coach today. I'm your assistant. And that was big for him because, you know, he got thrown into the fire of he's running practice and he's telling everybody where to go and how to do things. And, you know, that for him, I think was a good tool because now he's telling me, you know, hey coach, you know, I want you to do this rebounding drill. Here's how I want it done. Go ahead. You know, and that was big for his learning curve.
Absolutely. How do you divide up the tasks among your staff? Do you divide it up? One guy does offense, yep. One does defense. Do they have roles? Just explain how you go about putting that piece of it together.
Yep. So, you know, I think it's very similar to your team. You know, I always say it's like your second team as a head coach, and you always want to put your best guys at finding what their strengths are and put them in those spots. You know, I have one coach who's obsessed with defense, obsessed with it. Like he's going to clinics and he's watching everything, you know, he'll watch games and he'll just fast forward the offensive stuff. And I'm like, you know, like NBA games. And I'm like, dude, what are you doing? And that's what he's just obsessed with it. So, you know, he kind of grew and I said, you know, he wanted to be a defensive guy. I said, hey, I'll give you a couple years on my staff and, you know, prove to me you can do the defensive side. And now he does a lot of the defensive side, if not most of it, you know, just finding that niche. You know, I have another guy who's really good with numbers and good with stats and good with data. And, you know, his job is he's in charge of all our film and he's in charge of all our stats and he does all our, you know, when the media guys call and want to know how many points these guys have and, you know, he puts together the highlight films and the clips and all that stuff. So putting guys in what they're good at, you know, I think as a head coach, it's very similar to putting your, you know, your better players in good situations in which they're good at.
Absolutely. What do you look for? You just mentioned statistics. Do you have any favorite team stats, analytics, kind of new age things that you study, that you look at, or that you think really have an outsized impact on winning when you look at your program?
No, not too much. Not too much. You know, I definitely look at, we're big on, you know, who can shoot and who can't. That's a big one for us. You know, we run a lot of junk stuff. We junk it up. I haven't been blessed with a big team and tall team in a while. So if we're going to beat you, we gotta kind of junk it up a little bit. So if you can't shoot, we're not guarding you. You know, we're doubling off you. We're doing a whole bunch of stuff. So, you know, we're always trying to find ways to junk it up. And, you know, I think shooting is one of them for us. So we get, I'm big on like just massive amounts of just film so we can get the data of it. You know, that's a big one for us. You know, if coaches like, hey, you know, we blew them out by 50. Well, you know, I want the film just because I want the numbers. You know, I want to see what that kid shoots from three, and I want to see what he does. You know, and then tendencies is big for us. You know, so a lot of kids are working with these trainers, and they're good at, you know, when they go left, it's a pull up, and when he goes right, it's to the rim, and finding out what those tendencies are and just letting our guys know. So that just gives our guys a little bit more of an advantage in terms of, you know, just guarding guys one-on-one.
How much film are you personally watching? So to prepare for an opponent,
yep.
How many films are you watching of a team when you're preparing for them? And then how much film do you watch of your own team? Again, it probably varies depending on whether you're in the preseason, yep, or in the middle of the season, but just talk a little bit about, just give people an idea of just generally how much time you're spending on what kind of film.
I'd say, you know, preseason, it's usually just a game. You know, we're playing an opponent. You know, we don't know. You know, I'm watching their last game, maybe a little bit of a game prior to that. You know, once we get to league, it's probably two or three films of each team. And then playoffs, like, similar, maybe a little bit more depending on, you know, if I feel comfortable or not. A lot of it for me is can I sleep? I get to the point of like, you know what? I'm good. I know our game plan. I'm confident. Here's what we're going to do. This looks good. I can go to sleep now. Then I'm done. And that's usually my barometer for when I can stop watching film. And if I get to the point where it's like, you know what? I just don't know. Like, I don't know if it's going to work. This is not, all right, one more. Here we go. You know, and that's kind of where my barometer is where I can feel confident sleeping. So.
So how much time is that in the course of a given week? Let's say within the season, your team's playing two games.
Uh-huh.
How much film are you watching time-wise during that week?
I'd say between our own team and the other team, I'd say, maybe 4 hours a day, you know?
Okay.
Probably during the season, 4 hours a day, I'd say is probably a good barometer. Playoffs, maybe a little bit more. I teach PE, so while the kids are, you know, in and out and at break and stuff, you know, I'm watching 30 minutes here and there, and you know, they're changing and slowly walking out to take roll and things like that. I'm watching, you know, time there and lunchtime and things like that. So, you know, just trying to find time to make it work.
Gotcha. How much of that film work that you're doing, mm-hmm, how much do you share with your kids formally where you're all sitting down and watching that together? And then what's the breakdown of watching an opponent, mm-hmm, versus watching your own film?
Yep. We don't really show our guys much of the other team. And we try not to give them too much. You know, I think sometimes these coaches are inundating these kids with game plans that, you know, and all right, you know, here's 23 and there's 20 sentences about what number 23 is doing. You know, is he really going to remember that as he's running at the kid full speed on a closeout? You know, so which for us is just little tiny pieces on two or three guys. You know, for us, that's kind of where we're at. You know, I'm not really going into their third bench player and what he can do and what he can't do. And, you know, hey, if their third bench player beats us, we probably deserve to lose that game. And, you know, we're just going to try to take away their one or two guys and really focus on them. So we really try not to inundate our guys with too much data. We usually walk through, you know, two plays, their two most popular plays, how we defend it. I think a lot of coaches these days too, they're showing people, all right, here's what they run. Well, that's great. Well, how do we defend it? So for us, it's how we defend it. So we'll walk through it real quick, show how we're going to defend it, walk through an out of bounds play, maybe, you know, one that they run it, you know, a lot. You know, what we'll do is we'll also call out of bounds plays, other teams out of bounds plays, we'll name them. So that way, when you get to the point, you know, like, we'll say, you know, St. Anthony's four. So then we get to in the playoffs and another team's running that play. You know, they don't,
right,
hey guys, it's just St. Anthony's
four. You can make
four.
A call.
Right,
right.
Right. So, you know, then boom, it jogs our memory right back. So, but kind of keeping it just simple for them. Really focusing on those one or two guys. You know, we're probably watching 20 minutes of another team.
Gotcha. That's good stuff about renaming their out of bounds plays. I like that. I never have heard that before. Yeah. That's a really good idea because, again, now you're not tipping off the fact that you know what's coming.
Correct.
So that's a really good way to think about it. I like that. All right, let me ask you how you feel that you've grown since your first season as a head coach. What are one or two things that you feel like you've really gotten better at as a head coach over the course of your career?
Yep. I think one of them is for sure allowing my assistants to be coaches. You know, I remember my first couple of years I was coaching and my assistants were on the sideline and not doing much. You know, and I remember I met with them at the end of the year and said, hey, you know, what are some things you think I need to improve on? well, coach, you got to let me do something. You know, I think that was big for me. So I'm always at the start of the week, I text our coaches group chat, you know, hey, what's everyone's availability this week? And if you say you're going to be there, you're going to be part of practice. I'm building you in somehow, some way, whether it's a drill, whether it's you're doing a development thing towards the end of practice, whether it's, I need you to talk to our team 5 minutes about heart. You know, I'm building you some way into the practice plan, so you not only feel like you're a part of it, but the kids know that you're part of the game plan and you're helping contribute. Because as much as I think I know everything, I probably know less than 1% of what I can know, and what they can bring to the table is fantastic. So I want to make sure that they're involved in every aspect. And I'd say the second thing I think is just being more efficient. Kind of going back to the point you said, you know, 3 hour practices. You know, a lot of time I wasted a lot of time in my first couple of years coaching. You know, we were doing this elaborate stuff and these elaborate game plans and these elaborate practices where we're going through a million things. And, you know, we know kids these days, attention spans are not great. They always say, if you're talking for 20 minutes, you've talked 17 minutes too long.
For sure.
So, you know, just kind of being more efficient with practice, getting stuff done. You know, what really we need to work on. You know, do I need to spend 45 minutes on closeouts? Probably not. You know, couple minutes here, you know, twice a week. And, you know, okay, we're good. Move on. So just kind of hit little topics here and there and kind of just build out a weekly practice plan so we can kind of make sure we touch on the things we need to maybe a couple times a week for 2 minutes instead of working on it for 20 minutes.
So from a practice planning standpoint, do you have a series of go-to drills that sort of make up the bulk of your practice time, mm-hmm. or are you trying to get a lot of variance in terms of you have a skill that you're working on, but you might have 7, 8, 9, 10 drills that work on that particular skill? Or are you the guy that says, hey, we have this core drill that we're going to do because this helps us to improve this particular area that we need to really work on?
Uh-huh. So we start out practice every day. We stretch. I play rap music pretty loud in the gym while they're stretching, just to kind of get them excited for practice, a little energy in the gym, waking things up, and like that. And then we'll always talk for like 2 minutes, whether it's a topic about something that's going on in the news, or whether it's a topic about our games, or, you know, have a guest speaker talk for a couple minutes. And then we jump right into I always do a three-man weave. And the three-man weave we do is a little bit different than most three-man weaves. It's, if you don't sprint, though, it's timed. If you don't sprint the whole thing, if you don't make all your layups, it's a right-hand layup for each person. It's a left-hand layup for each person. They're running around cones in a funny way. It's a reverse layup, and it's with the right hand, it's a reverse layup with the left hand, and it's timed. And if they don't get in a certain amount of time, we start off with a little bit of running to start practice. And it just, for me, it's a lot of, you know, you got to be ready from the start of practice. You know, you got to kind of loosen them up a little bit. It makes them understand from the jump ball, we got to go. You know, it's full.
These guys dialed in.
Yeah, so. That's big for me. I have a coaching mentor of mine who played at University of Louisville for Denny Crum, and he would mention all the time that he would always do drills right when practice started. From the get-go, it was 100 miles an hour, and that was, he always would say, because that's how we have to start games. Because in a big game, you know, you can lose a game in the first 5 minutes, can't win a game in the first 5 minutes. So
no question.
Let's make sure we're ready to go from the start, and we'll do that. And then we'll do a little two-on-two drill. Where the ball gets thrown weak side, they gotta jump to the split line, and they gotta talk, and it's a little 2-on-2 action. We do that for about 6-7 minutes, and then we'll do a little 4-on-4 shell for about 10 minutes, and then we'll, you know, probably do defense for a while, and maybe a little bit of offense here and there, but for the most part, it's pretty defensive based from then on.
Got it. All right, so let me ask you this: you obviously had a tremendous amount of success at Chaminade. Mm-hmm. What was the impetus for you leaving Chaminade to take the opportunity to become the head coach at St. Francis?
You know, I think a little bit of it was just kind of time for a change. You know, we got, when I took over, the program was a little bit of disarray. It was, they weren't winning as much as they probably could. You know, and I felt, you know, that they felt it was, you know, it was at the bottom. You know, we were the last place in the league, and, you know, we took over, and we went, made it to the finals the first year, which was a little bit of luck, but a little bit of, I think, just trying to change the culture right away in that aspect. And I enjoyed really building that program into, you know, eventually winning a state championship.
Being without basketball right now is tough for all of us.
So we've partnered with Pro Skills Basketball to offer you a 50% discount on their Ultimate Shooting Guide and Video Program that will put players on a guided path to becoming the best shooter they can be. With 1 year's worth of workouts that includes games, drills, and competitions, players will gain access to a blueprint showing them what it takes to become an elite level shooter. If you're looking to improve your shooting at home, this program can help. Visit hoopheadspod.com/store to check it out. When you took over the job, what was the first thing that when you looked at the program, you said, if we're going to get to where I want to go, this or these things have to change? What were one or two things you said, I have got to instill this in this program if we're going to get to where I want to go?
Yep. I think one of them is it's the most cliche word now in basketball, but culture. You know, you got to change the culture of the program. You know, you got to hold kids accountable. You know, you gotta make sure that your standards and what you want and the people that you're getting in your program and are the right kind of people. You know, I tell people all the time, if you're interested in YouTube videos and clicks, you can go somewhere else. you know, I don't really want to coach those kind of guys. So that was a big part of it, is finding the right culture. You know, the kids that wanted to do the right things and wanted to hang their hat on the right things that I believed in. And kind of making sure that was change number one. And then number two was I felt like the program wasn't having any fun. And that was my next thing, was to just have instill more fun. Like, I always say there's a legal recruiting, and then there's recruiting where you can, you know, have a little fun, you know, and kids want to be at a school that's having fun. So, you know, trying to attract kids the right way by winning and doing the right things and, you know, putting a video on social media of us playing dodgeball at practice one day and, you know, having drones fly through campus and, you know, make hype videos and all that stuff that kind of promotes your program the right way and get back to having fun. So those were probably the two things I think we hung our hat on the most.
All right. So how do you define fun? What does fun mean to you? Because obviously there's a couple different definitions of fun that we could look at. But when you say fun, what does that mean? When you're looking at the vision of your program, what does that mean to you?
You know, I always say that you can always trick people into having fun. You know, hard work can be fun if you do it the right way. One of my coaching buddies, his name's Hernando Planels. He's a women's coach at Duke University. Yep. And he always talks about there's energy givers and energy takers and, you know, being contagious with your energy. And that was one thing I'm big on, you know, with my staff, is like when practice starts, we're getting after it. You know, we're having fun. We're getting after it. It's fast. It's quick water breaks. And then, you know, maybe it's a half court shot right after water is over, you know, and it's a free throw contest, you know, coaches versus players, you know, three quarters of the way through practice. And it's, seniors versus, you know, underclassmen for the last 5 minutes of practice, and the winner gets pizza. You know, all that stuff. Well, meanwhile, we've ran lines in between. We've done, you know, dive on the floor. We've done charges, and they don't realize that they've done all that bad stuff because they're looking forward to all the fun stuff. So I think you can kind of mask some of those tough drills that kids don't want to do these days, the closeouts and the box outs and the boring things, with mixing some fun stuff. And I think that was big for us to try to get kids to understand that we're going to work, but we're also going to have a little bit of fun too.
Was that something that you've developed over time, or was that something that kind of you realized pretty early in your career? Where did you come to the realization that fun piece had to be a part of what you were trying to do?
I think it was when I played in high school. You know, I had a coach who was a really, really good X's and O's guy, very good, but he didn't understand the other side of it, the fun, the interpersonal relationships, the bigger side of basketball, which I feel is becoming even more relevant today. So I was always like, I don't want to be like that guy in that extent. So what can I do so kids don't have to experience the same thing I experienced?
Just a guy understood.
Who understands X's and O's. So I don't want to bash him because he's a good dude. But, you know, I learned from his mistakes in a certain sense, and what would I have wanted as a player?
Yeah. And it's a different era.
100%.
As well. I think that's a part of it too. I think that what you just described is a much more common coaching philosophy in 1985 or 1995 than it is today, for sure. And so I think that that's something that we all have to take into account as we think back to, you know, our playing experiences. It's just kind of like you're in a different era, without question.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So when you start thinking about where you are now in the year 2020 and coaching at St. Francis, what is
the biggest joy that you get from being a high school coach in the year 2020?
That's a great question. Definitely number one for me is when my kids, my players come back.
We know exactly what you mean.
Yeah, when they come back. I mean, that's the coolest thing for me is, you know, not only being able to watch them, you know, like, you know, as more you coach, you start having kids playing in college and, you know, you get to turn on the TV and watch them, or, you know, you're going on Synergy or they're sending you clips and you watch them play. And that to me is awesome. But having them come back is really cool. And just seeing them grow and mature. And, you know, I've got to the point now where they're starting to get married and they're starting to have kids and families. And I mean, that's just awesome to me because you can really see, you know, not, I always say it's not about you as a coach, but sometimes, you know, you have dark days as a coach where you're losing games and things aren't going right. And then all of a sudden you get invited to a player's wedding and you realize, you know what? This is why I do that. You know, this is why this makes it all better. And, you know, we're doing the right thing. So that for me is the biggest thing.
Yeah. There's nothing more gratifying than that. Cause I think sometimes, and I can attest to this too, not only as a coach, but I'm sure you can attest to it as a teacher as well, is there are days where, you know, you have a tough day and you go home and you wonder like, man, did I have any impact at all today?
Yep.
And is what I'm doing having the type of impact on young people that I want to have? And we've all had days like that in our career. And then when you get that phone call that you just described and you hear that voice on the other end of the line say, hey, coach,
yep,
there's nothing.
Nothing.
There's nothing better than that. There's no more, I think, greater term of endearment than when you hear a former player who's now an adult call you coach. Mm-hmm. I mean, there just is, there's nothing like that. Mm-hmm. I know that everybody that has ever coached me, I don't think I could ever call them by their first name or by just, you know, they're just coach.
Yep.
And I think that that's something that, if you've been in this profession, you understand the meaning of that term, and you also understand that it doesn't come easily. Not everybody gets the right to be called, hey, coach, 15 years after they after they coach somebody.
I
think that you just described what, if you're in it for the right reasons, I think that just about everybody who's in it for the right reasons is going to say, when those players come back and when they've had success, and I judge my, you know, again, every one of us is competitive as all get out.
Right.
Our one loss record is really, really important to us. And I think that that's something that we all have to keep in mind. And yet at the same time, what really matters is those relationships that you built. And
right,
you talked about that right off the top, that what you remember about your high school career as a player or what you remember about a certain team is not necessarily the record of your team in 2007, 2008. What you remember is those kids and those memories and being on the bus and being in the locker room and coming through together. And those are the things that stand out. And even though in the moment, we all understand the importance of that one loss record, depending on what level you're coaching, that can obviously allow you to keep a job or lose a job.
Yep.
But ultimately, what really matters is the impact that you're having on young people. And I 100%. Think that you just described it really well in terms of somebody calling you up and saying, hey, coach, I just got a new job. Or, hey, coach, I'm getting married. I want you to come to my wedding. There's nothing that is better than that.
I agree. I always say, you know, you'll have a season where you'll have a group of seniors, let's say, and, you know, you go 6-20, and then, you know, you thought that season was a failure. Well, little do you know, those five seniors, you got two doctors and a lawyer and a, you know, a guy who's, you know, running for the politics, you know, and now you, looking back, well, we lost on the court, but we probably won. You know, and that's hard to kind of take in as a coach, but you know, unfortunately we're judged on our years that we were in front of us right away when we should really be judged on the years down the line. So.
Have you ever had a kid come back to you years after and share something that you said to them that you have no recollection of ever having said, that they say, this thing that you said to me has had a huge impact on my life, I always remember it or refer to it? Have you ever had anything like that happen to you?
I've had a couple. Yeah, I had one. I had a 7-foot Belgian kid who played for me, who ended up signing with the University of Washington, and he came from Belgium and was an unbelievable kid, but he was soft. And I always would be on, you know, his name was Gilles. I said, "G, get down the floor, run, get down the floor, get down the floor." He loafed down the floor.
Right.
I mean, I remember once he said to me that I said to him one time, I want you to run like there's a pack of wild dogs chasing you and you got meat in your pockets. And I don't really remember me saying that. I might have said it.
Right.
But that's what he said. And he said he always remembers that when he runs on the court is when there's a pack of wild dogs chasing you with meat in your pockets. So if I said it or I didn't, at least it stuck with him.
Exactly. That's one of the things that I love. I just think it's, you know, it's something that's as we get caught up in the day-to-day, whether it's coaching or teaching, you think about how much you talk as a coach or as a teacher, and a lot of those words just disappear and they're never to be heard from again. And yet something like what you just described, that kid's going to carry that with him until he's 95 years old. Yep. He's never, ever going to forget that piece of wisdom.
Yep.
And yet you have no recollection of whether you said it or didn't say it. And he's carrying that around with him, you know, and I'm sure it helped him on the basketball floor. And at some point it probably is applying to his life as well.
He's still playing overseas and he said he still thinks about it today, which is really cool. Yeah. So
that's amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing. That's what it's all about. All right. So we talked about the good stuff. Give me the biggest challenge for a high school coach in the year 2020. What's your biggest day-to-day challenge that kind of makes the job tougher?
It's a good question. I think that, you know, there's some, definitely the social media, I think, makes the job tougher. You know, it definitely makes it easier, but it makes it tougher. You know, you have kids nowadays where they're very worried about what other people are doing and they're not so worried about what they're doing. So you'll get a lot of, well, coach, you know, he just tweeted that he got an offer to this school. I'm way better than this kid. You know, well, you know, relax. Let's take it back a second. You know, we don't know what he's doing at practice. We don't know what his grades are. We don't know what he got on the SAT. You know, we don't know what the coach saw. You know, we don't know what the coach needs. You know, there's a million aspects, and I think kids get caught up so much with that is a big factor. And I think that's causing a lot of problems with coaches. It's tough because your kids are always comparing themselves to others. I think we do that as a human being in general. All the time, but I think it's more prevalent now with kids these days because they're seeing what other guys are doing on social media and they don't understand why they're not getting a part of it. So I think that's definitely one. And then, you know, I think the other one is the AAU thing. You know, I think there's a lot of positives into it. There's some negatives into it. You know, it's paid basketball, so kids feel like they can get up and leave all the time and they can transfer to this team and this team and who's going to play them. And, you know, that kind of that culture kind of spills over into the high school culture and makes it a little hard for us because, you know, we're not an AAU team. We have an institution and a school. And then for us, it's a religious, you know, religious school. So you have that behind the school. So you're not just giving up, you know, all that. We have a lot more to adhere to and to call to, and, you know, where the AAU programs really don't, which is fine. And I respect a lot of the AAU coaches and how they do it, and a lot of them do it really the right way. You know, but we have a lot more standards that we have to keep up as a high school coach.
All right, if you could wave a magic wand and reform, let's just call it summer basketball, from a high school coach's perspective, what are one or two things that what might it look like if you could wave your magic wand and sort of reform the summer basketball circuit? What would it look like from your perspective?
I would have no college coaches being able to see anybody in the summer. That for me would be the magic wand. Make them come out in the fall. Make them come out in the wintertime. Give them full eligibility access to come to high school practices and come to high school games and high school events and bring high school basketball back to where it was. In terms of, you know, you want to recruit a kid, you got to get out and you got to go to practice and you got to go, you know, you got to go to a tournament and sit down and watch all 8 games in a row and try to find guys. And, you know, for me, that was the cool part about, you know, basketball. And I think I understand the cost efficiency of a college coach going down to a AAU event and seeing 400 guys for a price of 1 plane ticket and 1 hotel room, where if he wants to go see my guy, he's got to do that, you know, times however many kids he wants to see. So I get that side of it, but I think it would be better to give the high schools a little more power.
Yeah, I think there's 2 arguments to be made. I think the argument in favor of AAU is, one, what you mentioned, just the time / cost efficiency. And the other thing I think that AAU does provide is you get an opportunity to see, especially when you're talking about the top level players,
right,
you're getting to see more of those guys on the same floor going against other guys of similar talent.
Right.
When you're out recruiting. So I think that's an advantage.
Right.
And yet, I think if I'm a college coach I would want to see a kid play for their high school as much as I possibly could and see their practice and talk to their high school coach, because ultimately the kid is going to have to play within my system. Whatever my system is,
right,
the kid is going to have to play in a system. So I would want to see, how does this kid fit in on a team where he has a defined role, whatever that,
right,
whatever that role might be. Right. And I just don't think you can see that in an AAU practice or in an AAU game. And to me, that would be a big forebearer of a predictor of what the kid's success is going to be at the college level, because so many kids in high school, obviously, if you're getting a chance to go and play at the college level, you're probably the first or second best player on your team, and right, you're probably playing a starring role. And we all know, just like we talked about in the NBA earlier, there's only so many stars as you go up a level. Right. And so how's this kid going to be able to adjust and play within a system? And I think that because high school coaches and the high school recruiting has been marginalized by the AAU system in some ways, and again, as we said, I understand why, and there are positives to being able to do that. 100%. But I just think as a college coach, I would want to spend more time observing that player within his high school environment, because I think it would give me a better idea of how he'd fit into my program.
100%. You know, we have a kid this year who's named Andre Henry. He's signed a full scholarship to UC Irvine. You know, if you're familiar with UC Irvine, but they went to the tournament the last couple of years. They actually beat TCU. They had Oregon on the ropes. You know, in recruiting him, he never saw him play in AAU. And I said, you know, hey, he's playing on this court at this time. You want to go see him play? We don't really care. you know, they went.
That's good to hear.
You know, they went and saw him a little, you know, every once in a while. But it was more like, you know, coach, send us his high school stuff. Send us his film when he was playing in senior summer events. How is he as a leader? What is he as a kid? You know, how is he in the classroom? Does he show up on time? You know, that was the stuff that they cared about. They wanted to see what happened when he was being full denied, and we had, you know, no shooters on the floor at that time. What could he do? You know, when we were down by two and we needed a bucket, what was he getting that? And that to me was like, this is a place where I feel he could be good at, because that's the kind of person he is and the kind of, you know, place I want to send one of my guys.
Yeah, I think that speaks to the fact that talent is everywhere.
Yep.
And you can find basketball talent, go to an AAU tournament, you can find guys who are talented, but talent doesn't always win. What wins is quality of character and all those little things that you just described. And I think the best coaching staffs, whether it's a high school coaching staff, whether it's a college coaching staff, and take it even one step further, whether you're an NBA organization, people are so much better about being able to identify who the quality people are and wanting those quality people to be a part of what they're trying to build. And
right,
that's where true success lies, because when you combine that talent with all those intangibles that you just talked about,
mm-hmm,
that's when you really start to have something. That's when you're really going to build the kind of program that you can be proud of, for sure.
Right.
All right, we're coming up close to an hour and a half here, Todd. So before we get out, I want to give you a chance to share your contact information so that if somebody listened to the podcast tonight, they can reach out to you if they want to ask a basketball question. Just share your social media. And then if you have any final parting shots, something that we didn't talk about or hit on tonight, you can go ahead and do that. And then I'll jump back on and we'll wrap up the episode.
Cool. Once again, my name is Todd Wolfson. I'm the head basketball coach at St. Francis High School. We're right outside Pasadena, California, right near the Rose Bowl. And you can find me on Twitter. My Twitter is at SFHSHoops. And that's probably the best way to contact me, and through social media. I'm on there. And you know, I just appreciate stuff like this and podcasts like this, because, you know, it can help anybody make basketball better. You know, that's partially why I'm in this game, is to, you know, see the game improve and help coaches and help people. And, you know, going back to that service aspect of being someone who can help others.
Absolutely. Todd, we can't thank you enough for spending an hour and a half with us tonight.
Thank you.
It's been a lot of fun getting an opportunity to share your basketball journey with you, and to be able to hear about some of the ways that you've been able to build such successful programs there in the state of California. So again, thank you. And to everyone out there, we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Hey everyone. Last year at the Junior NBA Summit, I came across an amazing company called iSport 360 and its founder, Ian Goldberg. Their youth sports app gets coaches, players, and parents on the same page. Your team can set goals, share player feedback, training videos, sticker rewards, player evals, and practice assignments. All of this to foster a healthy team communication and culture. If your team or club struggles to keep open lines of communication, especially among team parents, iSport 360 can help. If you want to empower your athletes to have more success, more confidence, and more communication with their teammates, give iSport 360 a try today. Shoot me an email, mike@hoopheadspod.com, or give me a call at 216-392-4059 to learn more.
Registration is now open at headstartbasketball.com for this summer's Head Start Basketball Camps. We'll be hosting camps for boys and girls in grades 1 through 6 throughout the greater Cleveland area. Get registered today and make sure you hit the courts with us this summer.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads Podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.